From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events in the Latin America Caribbean region from our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
Tony, welcome back. I haven't had time with all the stuff going on in the U.S. to pay much attention to what's been happening outside, except on the front of World War III around Russia and China. Maybe you could fill us in what's happening in Latin America and the Caribbean over the last week or so.
Yeah, well, there's been lots of stuff going on. Almost nothing of it has been really high profile. And maybe we should go through it country by country and just to get people up to speed on what's been happening over the last week or so.
Good idea.
So should we start with Venezuela?
Sure.
Okay, so in Venezuela, we've got the continuing attack by Secretary General of the Organization of American States, Luis Almagro, the former Venezuelan foreign minister, former Uruguayan foreign minister. And you may remember that last year he had a go at trying to unilaterally invoke what's called the Carta Democrática in Spanish of the Organization of American States, and I think the English translation is Democratic Charter. And of course, he himself is not entitled to do that. That has to happen from the country concerned itself, or some combination of a majority of OAS members. He can't really instigate that, and he's now trying to do that again. And it's a mystery to a lot of people why he thinks he's going to be able to get away with it a second time when he didn't succeed the first time. And I think we've mentioned earlier, in an earlier conversation, that as things stand, it looks as though he has no chance at all of marshalling together enough support from member countries of the Organization of American States to be able to push through his initiative to apply the Democratic Charter to Venezuela, which would mean that members of the Organization of American States would apply sanctions to Venezuela as a group, and there's virtually no chance of that happening. And it's very strange that Luis Almagro should insist on that. If you the document that he wrote that he's using as the basis for this second attempt to attack Venezuela using OAS mechanisms is outrageously partisan in its content and in its style, and it's just that his whole approach. It's like he doesn't seem to understand the balance of power has shifted so far now in the region against precisely that kind of intervention. That he's on a hiding to nothing. He's not gonna make any progress with it. The only countries that will really support it are probably the United States and Canada. Right. And Almagro is viewed very much in the region as a stooge of the U.S. State Department, and as somebody who's made a marriage with the devil in the form of the extreme right wing in the U.S. Congress. In, for example, people like Marco Rubio and Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, fanatical anti-Castro politicians from Florida.
Yeah, and Bob Menendez, so, too.
Yeah. So, and that's going on. And an interesting kind of footnote to it, or maybe that might turn into more than a footnote over the next few days. It remains to be seen how serious it'll turn out to be. A curious incident down on the Venezuelan border with Colombia, from the Venezuelan side. It's in the state of Táchira, which is a state that's notorious for its in the region's involvement in cross-border smuggling,
right,
and paramilitary activity from the Colombian side. And as the border there is along a river, and that river is very unstable, and it shifts. So it's what the actual border is physically, literally changes from one rainy season to the next. And so, what apparently has happened is that a Venezuelan operation to remove some Colombian paramilitaries who'd established themselves on the Venezuelan side of the border involved Venezuelan troops possibly crossing over into Venezuela. And the Colombian media, in hot
into
pursuit
Colombia.
Of the...
Yeah, you mean into Colombia.
The paramilitaries. And of course, the Colombian paramilitaries are closely associated with very high-level Colombian politicians, the most well-known being Álvaro Uribe, former president of Colombia. And they make their living drugs trafficking, smuggling, fuel, and engaging in all kinds of perhaps lower-level smuggling, but in a way that's deliberately designed to destabilize the Venezuelan economy. It's very important for the Venezuelan army to and keep those paramilitary forces along the Venezuelan-Colombian border under control. But the response in Colombia has not been, oh, well, we'd better send the Colombian army to help our Venezuelan colleagues, our Venezuelan partners combat the scourge of paramilitarism. No, that's not been the Colombian government's response. The response of the Colombian government has been, oh, we've been invaded by Venezuela. We'll have to send the Colombian army to defend Colombian territory. And I think that speaks volumes about the dangers facing the Colombian peace process. Because the Colombian peace process depends greatly on what Colombian government policy is going to be about dismantling and disarming the Colombian paramilitaries, who are regarded by many as, in important senses, an extension of the Colombian army in terms of the security policy applied by the Colombian government. Historically, certainly against the FARC, the paramilitaries have been working in a coordinated way with the Colombian armed for the regular Colombian armed forces. And now that the peace process is underway in Colombia, the big question is: well, now that the peace process is underway, why is there any need to maintain any semblance of a paramilitary structure, and why is that? Why should that be defended at all? And so, this latest incident along the Venezuelan-Colombian border is extremely disturbing, in the sense that it's a clear indication that the Colombian government is not serious about controlling paramilitary crime in Colombia. And that has big implications for the effective implementation of the Colombian peace process. So let's see how that pans out over the next couple of weeks. But it's quite a depressing development from the Venezuelan government's point of view, when they've bent over backwards to work with the Colombian authorities to address the issue of smuggling and contraband that affects both countries' economies. And now they have this incident in which, instead of cooperating with the Venezuelan army against Colombian paramilitaries, the Colombian government seems to be acting in a way that is de facto going to protect paramilitary activity along the Colombian side of the border.
Which doesn't make sense for them politically, because the smuggling is a part of the funding of the paramilitaries that the government is challenged by, in essence. And so it seems that by stepping in on the side of the paramilitaries, in this particular case, the government is actually strengthening its main adversary.
Well, who knows? I mean, there may be a kinder interpretation to make, namely that the government has to take that line, because if it doesn't, it's going to come under serious political attack from extreme right-wing political elements led by Alvaro Uribe, who are very critical of the peace process, right, and have been very critical of the peace process right from the start. So maybe there's something going on like that. But yeah. Given the record of Juan Manuel Santos, it's difficult to know how charitable an interpretation one should put on what he does, especially when it looks as though it's going to sabotage something that is really, really important for the Colombian people. It's not clear at all what in which direction he's going. But as I say, we'll see over the next few weeks, I guess.
So meanwhile, we're a week away from the Ecuadorian presidential election and the Ecuadorian election, and suddenly this October surprise for Guillermo Lasso, with not only does it turn out he has corporations domiciled in Panama, in other words, the famous Panama list, but he actually has a bank there.
Yeah, which he sold to himself.
Which may hurt him a lot.
I hadn't thought about discussing too much about Ecuador, because I thought we might cover it in another program. But looking at it at the moment, there seems very little chance that Lasso is going to be able to mobilize enough support to defeat Lenin Moreno, the candidate of the ruling government party Alianza País, and the person who's regarded very much as the successor to Rafael Correa. If you look at the reports of opinion polls in the country, and different opinion polls will give you different results, of course, but none of them are predicting a win for Lasso that I've seen. And the margin of victory ranges from anything from 2 to 3% up to 10%. So unless there's a real upset over the next week or so, it looks as though Lenin Moreno is going to win. And one of the reasons he's going to win, there are various reasons, and as I think we discussed in an earlier conversation, there are various reasons why Lenin Moreno is likely to win. But the main reason he's likely to win, given the information that's come into the public domain over the last couple of weeks, is the perception that Lasso is a corrupt crook. And there are so many ways of looking at the Ecuadorian election, and people, quite well-known Argentinian figures like Diego Maradona have come out saying they've publicly made an appeal to the people in Ecuador not to make the mistake that the Argentinian people made.
Right.
Back in November 2015, when they voted for the right-wing phony
Macri.
Mauricio Macri. So it'll be a huge upset, as from everything that I can gather, if Guillermo Lasso manages somehow to defeat Lenin Moreno in the presidential runoff that's scheduled for today week, April 2nd.
Yeah, I mean, according to a report in Telesur, if it's proven that Lasso sold it to himself, which is what we found out from the Panama Papers leak, he could be charged with embezzlement and be imprisoned.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting reversal of the way right-wing forces in the region have been able to use
corruption,
judicial mechanisms, and manipulate judicial mechanisms, and as you say, the whole motif of corruption to make life difficult to actually oust President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and to make life extremely difficult for leaders like Lula da Silva in Brazil, and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. Can we go back to Venezuela for a moment?
For sure.
Another interesting thing that happened in relation to Venezuela over the last week is that President Nicolas Maduro announced that Venezuela is joining the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and as a full member. Now, if you look at that, that is very, very interesting, because running through the list of countries that are members of the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, Venezuela is the only Latin American member. And that, I find that extremely surprising, although perhaps I shouldn't, because with all the talk around the Trans-Pacific Partnership that has now been put into crisis as a result of President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from that proposed agreement. And with all the momentum that Mexico, Chile, Colombia, and Peru had managed to put into what they're calling the Pacific Alliance, and all of those countries were members of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but none of them are members of the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. And that, you know, the fact that Venezuela is now a full member, or is not now, but it's scheduled to be a full member.
Right, it's a prospective member now, non-regional prospective member.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank once a year decides on who are going to be its new members, and at their next meeting, the Venezuela has announced that they expect to be ratified as a full member. So that raises the whole issue of what is going to be the relationship of Latin America to Asian trading partners, in particular China, of course, but not just China, because if the ASEAN countries are working now with China in its regional comprehensive economic partnership framework, which was China's answer to the TPP,
right,
because the TPP specifically excluded both China and India.
Right.
But what China's done is they've set up what they call this regional comprehensive economic partnership, which involves most of the Pacific countries that were members of the TPP, except all the Latin American countries that were signing up for the TPP.
Right.
And now you've got Venezuela kind of leapfrogging over the Pacific Alliance countries,
right,
and becoming a full member of the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank.
And Peru is coming in also, and so is Ireland and Hungary and Canada,
right,
and Hong Kong regionally.
Right. When I was looking for Peru in among the members of the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank, and I didn't see it. I mean, it's interesting that you saw it there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website, and it has has two classifications: regional prospective members and non-regional prospective members. The regional ones are Afghanistan, Armenia, Fiji, Hong Kong, and Timor-Leste, and non-regional are Belgium, Canada, Ethiopia, Hungary, Ireland, Peru, Republic of Sudan, and Venezuela. It's an interesting set.
Right. So that's very interesting, because obviously I was looking at a website that's out of date, but because I didn't see Peru among the prospective members. Excuse me. But that's extremely significant in regional terms, because it indicates some kind of realignment in the way Latin America is going to integrate with its Asian trade partners.
Right.
It looks like something of a strategic setback from the point of view of the United States, because under the TPP, the United States was going to enjoy a much more advantageous position vis-a-vis all the Pacific trading countries, but in particular in relation to its Latin American partners, who were working very much in concert with the US State Department on that TPP initiative. And now that's all fallen to bits. And there's a realignment going on that may turn out to be much more positive from the point of view of regional integration.
Yeah, because go ahead.
I was just going to say that many people view the Pacific Alliance as an attempt to resurrect in some shape or form the notorious free trade agreement of the free trade area of the Americas that was President George Bush II's pet project for keeping Latin America under control and very much under the influence of United States economic and political power. That fell through thanks to Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez, the much lamented Nestor Kirchner, and Lula da Silva, when they defeated that initiative at a summit in, I think it was Mar del Plata in Argentina, back in whenever it was, 2004. And the Pacific Alliance is an attempt to try and kind of reinstate that in a way that is perceived as undermining the drive towards regional integration and regional unity into which Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, Lula da Silva, and so many other leaders, Rafael Correa, Evo Morales, Cristina Kirchner, following her husband's death, and all these leading politicians, and in most people regard as visionary politicians, with a strong vision of South American unity and emancipation from foreign interests, in particular North American, but also European interests. And that vision is seen as being undermined by the Pacific Alliance. And so what's happening now is Venezuela joining the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. It's almost as though there's a kind of counterattack, a diplomatic and trade counterattack going on, in particular by the ALBA countries. And I think we should perceive Cuba's growing relationships with, for example, Vietnam, which is a member of ASEAN, and with China, the Nicaraguan canal, the interoceanic canal that's scheduled to be built with Chinese capital, and all these things are all these initiatives are ways in which the progressive countries in Latin America are trying to promote a progressive style of regional integration based on cooperation and solidarity and trade complementarity and all those progressive ideas, which are anathema to globalists and to international corporate capitalism. Those countries, through their developing relationships, in particular with China, but with the Asia in general, are kind of acting in a way that's going to enable them to perhaps not reverse, but certainly to contain attempts by Peru, Colombia, Chile, and Mexico to expand a more free trade, free market, neoliberal style ideology into the mechanisms of regional integration.
Yeah, it's an interesting move. And, you know, if you're looking at the development of, regional integration and, building of the sovereignty and right and the ability of self-determination, of course, you know, the main expression of that in international trade would be to be able to go to wherever they'd like to trade as independent players. We want to buy cars. We can talk to China and the United States and the EU and cut the best deal that we can, rather than being locked into, you know, Monroe Doctrine trade relations with the United States.
Right. And so that's another a trend that I hadn't really taken much notice of until that announcement by Venezuela. But it does seem to be a very real policy strand that we should keep track of over the next year or so.
Yeah.
And then other things are happening. There are things happening, for example, in Chile, and the relationship between Chile and Bolivia. And in Chile, there was a big demonstration, I think it was yesterday, and of a huge number of people, hundreds of thousands of people, demonstrating against the Chile's pension system, which is a privatized system. And I don't know what the pension system is like in the States, but in Chile, the pension system has been privatized. It was privatized under the Pinochet dictatorship. And there have been attempts at reform over the years. The last attempt, was by Michelle Bachelet's first government back in 2008. But there's an enormous widespread dissatisfaction in Chile about the country's pension system, and I just thought that's an interesting issue that has come up at that, and there's been protests against Chile's pension system for some time, and it was just interesting to see that I think it was not last week but the week before, the President Temer, the usurper president in Brazil, was trying to push through pension reform along neoliberal free market lines, and he had to row back on that because the protests were so massive in Brazil against that. He had, at least for the moment, he's had to shelve the proposals that he had in mind to reform Brazil's pension system in favor of the private sector. Now in Chile, the pension system was privatized, and as I said earlier, there have been attempts at reform, but the reforms are still regarded with great dissatisfaction by the majority of people in Chile. Something I find puzzling about the Chilean pension system, perhaps I shouldn't, is that in theory, people have a statutory obligation once they enter employment to enter into Chile's formal pension system. But apparently one of the big problems with the Chilean pension system is that it only covers 60% of the working population. So, the only thing that I can think of, perhaps you've got a better take on this than me, but the only reason that I can see why 40% of the population would not be covered by what is supposed to be a statutory pension system is that they're in the informal economy and are not in formal employment. That's a big. There's a great resentment among especially low-income people in Chile, because the benefits they get from paying into that system all their lives don't correspond to what is really necessary to have a dignified retirement. And that's that whole issue of pensions is, it's a global issue, isn't it? So the reason I regard that as a very important issue in regional terms, not just in national terms, in Chile, is because it is all part of the conflict and the argument, the political argument about what is the role of the state, and what are people's real human rights, and is it a human right to have a decent pension on which to retire? And the right wingers will say, well, of course not, and socialists and progressives will say, well, of course it's absolutely a fundamental right that any society, especially the kind of prosperous societies that exist in most of Latin America, certainly have an obligation to guarantee. And so this national argument in Chile about pensions is one that is extremely relevant to the overall regional arguments about what is the role of government and what is the role of progressive policies in providing a decent life to the majority of people in the respective countries of the region. So that's going to be interesting to follow, to see how that pans out in Chile.
Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always. And we'll pick up next week talking about some of the things like the border incident between, with Chile and its neighbors, Bolivia particularly, and some other things. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Don. Bye now.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.